We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we find out the secrets Santa uses to make his Christmas rounds from the author of the book, The Truth About Santa, Wormholes, Robots, and What Really Happens on Christmas Eve. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Occasionally, good things can come from someplace unexpected. For example, in the western Illinois town of Monmouth, something good came out of an act of vandalism. Rich Edgar explains.
The story begins in 2008. Taggers were leaving their mark on a number of buildings in town. Residents were getting angry. Then the group tagged the Buchanan Center for the Arts. The center's new director, Susan Toomey, did not get angry. Instead, she took a different approach.
So I wrote an open letter to them and taped it to the side of our building and told them that I appreciated their use of color and form and that I thought that, you know, they had enough creative talent that we could do something more constructive. And if they were interested, to come and see me.
And they did.
Yes, they did. They did. They came.
They didn't suspect this was a setup by the police or anything.
Well, you know, it was kind of funny. I mean, they could have. I mean, I've told them subsequently that I'm so proud of them. I mean, it took a real leap of faith on their part to come in and talk to me because they had no idea what they were walking into. And there were three kind of, you know, scruffy-looking kids standing in the front door saying, "Are you Susan?" And I said, "Yes. Are you the Two-Wheeled Mafia?"
One of those scruffy-looking kids is Bobby Hall. He was home when someone stopped by and told him about the note at the Art Center.
I was like, "Well, that's kind of funny. Let's go up and look at it." And it asked us to come in. We were kind of suspicious on whether it was, you know, just like a trap, you know, see if we'd come in and get us arrested or not. And figured, you know, what the hell, go for a shot. Went in and it was legit.
Susan Toomey nicknamed the kids the Lost Boys. She says she knew right away they were good kids. She says they simply needed some guidance and attention. Toomey suggested they create a mural on one of the Art Center's outside walls.
They asked me very sweetly about Broke My Heart. They said, "Gosh, do you have a theme you'd like us to follow?"
What they settled on was a distorted city landscape of Monmouth. It's done in graffiti style. Part of it is in shades of gray. There are two big spray cans on either side of the illustrations buildings.
And as the spray comes out of the cans and hits the buildings, it becomes colored. So those parts of the mural are in color, and the rest of it's black and white.
A couple of the Lost Boys moved on, but Bobby Hall stuck around. He's working on the mural with Tiffany Davis. She's known Hall for years. Davis thinks it's cool to have their work displayed in a public place.
A wall that you walk by every day and you wish that you could just put graffiti all over, but you never have the chance to.
Do you see a lot of walls in town that look like blank canvases to you?
Oh, yeah. I see them all the time.
This wall is in a walkway between the Art Center and the library. A lot of people come through here. One such person is Daniel Jacobson of Monmouth.
It's nice to see that instead of using their graffiti ability to go out and spray the heck out of something, you know, and make it look terrible, that they're taking and they're beautifying part of the city with it.
What Bobby Hall likes about graffiti art is that you cannot simply pick up a wall and take it someplace else.
It brings people to it, more or less. You can't just pass it around like a note. They have to come to it and look at it, which in turn makes them want to see others. And it also helps them get outside. We're fighting obesity, too.
I didn't know graffiti could cure all of society's ills, but
it's anything is possible when you have spray paint.
And Susan Toomey feels anything is possible with art in general. She considers it a vehicle for change. That's certainly been the case here. Bobby Hall now holds down a full-time job at Alexis Fire Equipment. He hopes to start taking some college classes to work on his painting technique. Hall doubts he would have considered doing that if he had not gotten involved with the Art Center.
Probably wouldn't have, no. I'd probably be in jail.
The mural remains a work in progress. Hall and Davis are both busy, Hall with his job and Davis with classes at Monmouth College. Plus, materials are not always easy to come by, though some businesses have donated paint and other supplies. No matter how the mural ends up, Susan Toomey is happy with the way things worked out. Does she have any closing thoughts?
No, just if they ever hear the story, just so they know how proud I am of them.
Apparently, the feeling is mutual. Remember the typewritten note, the one that encouraged the Lost Boys of Monmouth to put their talents to better use? Bobby Hall says he still has it, folded up and kept in his room. Rich Egger reporting.
This is Sidetrack. Smith College in Massachusetts is one of the nation's most academically rigorous women's colleges and alma mater to several notable feminists, including Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan. So one thing people don't expect to find on campus are cheerleaders. A new Smith Spirit Squad is bucking that stereotype and raising questions about women's roles in athletics and who owns the definition of feminist. Karen Brown has more.
Take it to the floor. Come on, Smith, let's soar. Take it to the floor.
Much better.
Come on, Smith, let's soar.
Should we just do that every time?
Yeah, that looks good.
About two dozen young women in tank tops and sweatpants are lined up in two rows, learning to chant and clap in unison. They're holding cheerleading practice on a grassy field outside the campus gym.
How does that feel?
That was good.
This is the Smith College Spirit Squad, a two-year-old team of women who cheer on other women from the sidelines at rugby, volleyball, and basketball games. Unlike traditional co-ed sports schools, this squad is mostly made up of women who had never cheered before, like Nicole Rothenberger.
I went to a high school where cheerleading was very stereotypical, very catty, and I definitely had a lot of mixed feelings about joining the cheering squad just because I've been an upper-level gymnast, and a lot of times you're either a cheerleader or you're definitely against cheerleading.
Rothenberger's teammates also say it took some self-convincing to even try out. 19-year-old Alex Golden had been a jock in high school.
Well, I never saw myself as a cheerleader. I always saw myself as, you know, a varsity athlete, softball player.
And Lorna Sylvester was a drama kid who made fun of the cheerleaders.
Oh, we used to just, like, call them ditzes and airheads. And
so how do you figure you guys are not like that?
Different? Well, the sheer fact that this is Smith College, I think, provides a little bit of intelligence to the squad.
The majority of Smith cheerleaders are science majors. What got them to put on the red and black mini-skirted uniforms was the realization that this cheering squad is a twist on the stereotype. Again, Nicole Rothenberger.
It's a very different atmosphere cheering for a women's college, cheering with women who are so academically focused, but at the same time want to show their spirit and enthusiasm for athletics on Smith College.
But while these women have made peace with their preconceptions of pom-poms, the same cannot be said of the entire Smith community. This fall, when Smith officials posted a video of the Spirit Squad on the college's Facebook page, a lively discussion ensued. Current students and recent graduates were largely supportive, but many older alumnae were shocked.
My gut reaction was, I can't believe there's cheerleaders at Smith.
Lisa Hyder graduated from Smith in 1983 on the heels of the failed Equal Rights Amendment. She was among those chiming in on the Facebook page, most raising questions about the school's feminist credentials.
Saying, well, you have to understand that we're coming from a different place, and cheerleaders to us, it's sort of the anti-feminist ideal of the pretty woman cheering on the guys to victory while they're out there on the field actually doing something. And sometimes it seems to me like young women today take for granted some of the things that feminists fought for.
If anything, I would say the Spirit Squad is pro-feminist in the sense that we're a group of strong women supporting strong women.
Cheerleader Nicole Rothenberger.
And in my view, feminism is more about being able to have freedom and having not having boundaries set in front of you. And by people saying, you know, cheerleading is, you know, not feminist, and that's like setting a boundary saying we can't do it.
Bridging the feminist generation gap is not the only challenge for these neophyte cheerleaders. There's also the jumping, yelling, dancing, and gravity-defying human pyramids.
See how we're all doing it at different times? Okay, let's like go through it at regular pace. Okay.
Smith hired cheerleading coach Garnett Sherry, who has trained more traditional cheerleaders at co-ed schools, to bring the team up to professional standards. She says the women are certainly smart and committed enough to learn the moves. They just need to move beyond their cerebral tendencies and embrace the showmanship.
When it comes to them being naturally excited, that was something that we had to practice. They had to get over that fear of being judged and really take on the role of leading a crowd and being confident in what they were doing, regardless if it felt kind of silly or awkward. They realized that they got a much more positive response.
Beat the rivals! Beat!
None of these women are planning a career with the Dallas Cowboys, but they say they're proud of how far they've come. Last year, the Smith Spirit Squad had only 9 members and still won the award for Best Student Organization. This year, the squad has almost tripled in size, and the stunts are getting more elaborate with every game. I'm Karen Brown.
Beat the rivals!
Let's focus on clapping together, too.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. The Hoover Dam, a monument to man's engineering talents. But as independent producer Nate DeMeo explains, designers of a monument to the workers went through astronomical lengths to commemorate the makers of that dam.
In 1931, at the height of the Depression, people began hearing that there were going to be jobs in Nevada. They needed men there to build an enormous dam that would be named after President Herbert Hoover. 5,000 men, former commodities traders, former obstetricians, packed up their families and drove to the desert, some of them leaving behind the plywood and scrap metal shanty towns that were also named after Herbert Hoover. When they got there, they found that there were jobs, but that the houses and schools and movie theaters that were supposed to be there hadn't been built yet. So they hammered some posts into the ground and strung up some sheets that could keep the desert sun off their kids and their wives, and they went to work. 96 of those men died when the harnesses that fastened them to the canyon wall 800 feet in the air snapped. When the hearts of 50-year-old men who were used to selling women's hosiery were teaching geometry, when their hearts gave out after working 10-hour shifts in 130-degree heat, chipping a mile-long tunnel beneath the desert inch by inch. When others fell into wet concrete and had to be pulled out, not before they died, then before the concrete set and they became a permanent part of a large public works project. But not long after they finished the dam, orange groves and alfalfa fields and baseball diamonds and whole cities grew in the desert. There's a monument at the Hoover Dam. There are these two enormous bronze angels that are supposed to embody the spirit of the men who designed and built the dam, in American progress or whatever. But my favorite part of the monument, my favorite thing about the whole damn dam, is actually at the angels' feet. There's an Art Deco astronomical chart there, done in terrazzo, and it's lovely. And there's some text there that tells you that on September 20th, 1935, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt dedicated the dam. The text goes on to explain that the chart on the ground shows the precise alignment of the heavens at exactly 8:56 when FDR spoke, the same moment that a flagpole that stands between the two angels was aimed straight at the heart of the sun. Because they were sure we would care. There's a separate section on the chart that supposedly depicts the precise astronomical location of an Egyptian pyramid when it was aligned, Hoover Dam flagpole style, with the yonder star that the frankincense-toting wise men followed to get to the baby Jesus, thereby ushering in the Christian era. I love this, because it means that so convinced were the makers of the Hoover Dam that what these men had just built was so world historic, so new epic usheringly awesome, that a plaque wouldn't suffice. So they designed this chart, working with astronomers at the Naval Observatory at the Smithsonian. So thousands of years from now, even in an apparently post-English world, when the text right there next to the chart would somehow have been rendered useless, people, or perhaps aliens, could know. They'd be able to do the math and figure out the exact moment when FDR had a day clear in his calendar to say a few words at the Hoover Dam, now the 35th largest hydroelectric plant in the world, and according to the state's tourism website, the 9th best thing to do in Nevada. Number 10 is golf.
That was independent producer Nate DeMeo. You can hear his podcast, The Memory Palace, at www.thememorypalace.us. From Snow White to Hannah Montana, the Walt Disney Company knows how to use music to capture the hearts and cash of generations of kids. And those songs lead to theme park rides and Broadway shows. Eric Malinsky looks into how Disney used music to build its empire.
Disney got into the music business by accident. Usually the songs written for Disney cartoons were instantly forgotten. But in 1933, Disney put out a cartoon called The Three Little Pigs, which featured this little tune.
Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? Big bad wolf, big bad wolf. Who's afraid of the big bad wolf?
It's generally seen today as kind of an antidote to the Depression because so many people figuratively had the wolf at the door. In Three Little Pigs, they could see the pigs conquering their wolf.
J.B. Kaufman has written several books about Disney animation, and he consulted with the Disney Museum.
Before the end of 1933, it was in the repertoire of dance bands, and it had been recorded by a number of jazz singers. It became a whole new phenomenon for the Disney studio. They now had a hit song on their hands, and they were allied with the popular music business.
Walt seized on this opportunity. He had reflected popular taste, but now he wanted to shape it. In 1937, Snow White featured the song "Someday My Prince Will Come," a serious love song between cartoon characters.
Someday my prince will come. Someday we'll meet again.
This was actually cutting edge, an original song to advance the plot. Snow White came out 6 years before Oklahoma opened on Broadway, and that's usually considered the first modern musical.
And by this time, there had been several Disney features that continued this idea of wonderful songs, songs that are capable of standing on their own, but in context are woven into the flow of the story.
Then Walt became more ambitious. In the movie Fantasia, he combined classical music with animation. But Fantasia was a flop. I mean, most of the classic Disney features lost money. Walt was afraid the studio would go under. So after the war, Walt Disney Inc. came out with a new model. They went multi-platform, cross-promoting Disney material through consumer products, theme parks, movies, and TV shows like The Mickey Mouse Club, featuring the Mouseketeers.
Time to twist our Mouseketeers.
They saved the studio, but Disney was no longer pushing musical taste. They were borrowing from popular styles. Richard Sherman and his brother Bob wrote songs for Annette Funicello, who was kind of the Hannah Montana of the 1950s.
And one little song we wrote called Tall Paul brought us to the attention of the boss.
Disney was impressed.
So he says, well, call me Walt, for God's sake. And that's when we became his staff songwriters. The only staff songwriters he ever had, actually.
The Sherman brothers brought Disney music to a new level of stickiness. The Shermans wrote Mary Poppins. The Jungle Book. And one of the biggest earworms of all time.
It's a small world.
It was originally written for the 1964 World's Fair. Disney had been asked to create a ride with characters from around the world singing songs in their own languages, but it was a mess, so we called in the Shermans.
People say, oh, it's such a simple song, but it isn't simple. It's a world of laughter and a world of tears. It's a world of hopes and a world of fears. There's so much that we share that it's time we're aware. It's a small world after all. That's a very, very deep prayer. It's a prayer that we should respect each other and love each other and not fight and disagree all the time. It came from our hearts and came from Walt's heart because he said, yeah, that'll work.
After Walt died, the Disney musical fell on hard times. That is until 1989, when Broadway composers Howard Ashman and Alan Menken wrote The Little Mermaid. But with the breakout success of Hannah Montana, the Disney brand has something really valuable. Disney is cool again, at least if you're nine.
I don't think they had done it since the days of like Annette Funicello and the Mouseketeers. It's been that long, but they're firing on all cylinders now. They have it figured out.
Danny Strick is a music publisher. He signed the Jonas Brothers, who, if you don't know, are kind of a light punk band for kids. He helped them get a deal with Disney, and he was amazed when he watched the marketing machine kick in.
By the time the Jonas Brothers' debut album came out, there already was a huge awareness. I was able to witness that really just with my kid and her friends and them wanting to go see shows and knowing every lyric and deciding which one was the one they liked. Very reminiscent of, you know, sort of an early Beatlemania type thing, you know.
Grown-ups can complain all they want. One angry father blogged, Hannah Montana's not a girl, she's a product, she's Pepsi, she's Coke, she's a living nightmare. Disney may not be advancing artistic taste, but some parents are worried that Disney is pushing an agenda.
Miley Cyrus, she's dancing with a pole, are you kidding me?
I think if we really take a look at all of the Disney stars over the past several years, there comes a time when all of them want to assert their independence and say to us, you know, hey,
Disney
I'm
teen
no
stars like
I'm
Miley Cyrus, who plays Hannah Montana, are notorious for ditching their wholesome image at the height of their popularity. Or take Vanessa Hudgens, the star of Disney's retro High School Musical franchise. Her ex-boyfriend leaked nude photos of her on the internet. Parents were outraged, but Disney stuck with her.
I just don't think that would have happened, you know, 10 years ago. It's just my opinion, but I don't think they would have been able to handle it. And it just tells you that I think that people are aware of how things are today. If you have kids, they have access. It's just, and if you think you're protecting them in your house, they go to a friend's house. I think it's the world's evolving a little bit on that front.
Today, Disney's relationship with their teen pop stars reflects parents and kids in the internet age. The brand still promotes family values, but ask any parent, family values aren't what they used to be.
Now it's time to say goodbye to all our company. M-I-C.
See you real soon.
K-E-Y.
Why? Because we like you.
M-O-U-S-E.
I'm Eric Molinsky.
You're listening to Sidetrack. Recently, thousands of supporters of former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin have been turning up for book signings around the country. But even some of Palin's opponents are kind of curious to hear what's in her new book, Going Rogue. Last month, a Kansas City theater director gathered together a bunch of actors to do a dramatic reading of the book. They imagined it as part Greek tragicomedy and part drinking game. Independent producer Sylvia Maria Gross was there.
The tiny room's full of people, probably all lefties, and eager to relive some of the goofier moments of last year's election.
There's just so many good memories.
Who's that little creepy, like, omen-ish girl in the center?
Ethan Poe's pointing at the slideshow of Palin images flickering on the back wall. He's a student at KU, drove down from Lawrence with a couple of friends, fully prepared to mock.
There's something genuinely intriguing about Sarah Palin. I'm not sure if it's good, though.
I want to thank everybody for coming out. This is Going Rogue at the Fish Tank. Inspired by the release of Sarah Palin's book, Going Rogue in American Life, and the subsequent media frenzy.
Producer Lisa Cordes stayed up all night earlier this week reading the 400-page book and did a little editing. But she thinks this is natural theater.
If you were writing her in a play, actually, probably people would say, oh, that's not realistic. The idea of an unknown suddenly being thrust upon the stage, somebody who was sort of outside the political spectrum. And we thought it was very Greek to put this hero, heroine, if you will, major political figure up on stage and look at the sort of tragicomedy that, you know, is her life.
Cordes says she's a little conflicted about how Palin was treated as a woman during the election, but that doesn't stop her from having fun with the book.
Now, here's how this works. You drink when Ronald Reagan is mentioned, drink when folksy language is used, drink when the media is bashed, drink when you hear any of the following words, which are her children's names, Piper, Trig, Track, Trip, Willow, or Bristol. When you hear dang, you not only drink, but you yell out, dang!
The ground rules laid out, and they're off.
Chapter 1. The Last Frontier. It was the Alaska State Fair, August 2008, with the gray Tiquitna Mountains in the distance and the first light covering of snow about to descend on Pioneer Peak. I breathed in an autumn bouquet that combined everything small-town America with rugged splashes of the last frontier. Cotton candy and foot-long hot dogs, halibut tacos, and reindeer sausage.
I couldn't have been more than 4 years old and was walking to my friend's house all by myself because in such a small town, little kids gain their independence early.
Yay!
I sliced open fish bellies, scraped out the eggs, and plopped the roe into packaging. All of us on that job thought it was hilarious that the company would slap a caviar label on the delicacy and sell it to elite customers for loads of money. Practically every kid in Alaska has spent at least one summer working some kind of slime line.
I thought, okay, I know what he's going to say. Strike one, at 32, I was too young. I'd be the youngest mayor in Wasilla's history. Strike two, I couldn't win because I was a woman. I would be the first woman elected under the strong mayor form of government. And strike three, I knew he'd tell me I didn't have enough experience. I looked at him and waited.
The three strikes against you are Track, Bristol, and Willow.
My kids are strikes?
We moved into the mayor's mansion. Oh, gosh. She talks about Ronald Reagan for a long time again. Okay. And then we're on chapter 3, which is called Drill, Baby, Drill.
Oh, that's right.
Glancing out through the end of the tunnel, I could see the crowd and flashes of red, white, and blue. John's blue and gold posters emblazoned with his campaign message, Country First, rippled in the stands. I was proud of the senator.
So out of the box,
I thought.
I kept a stack of cards as a souvenir. I wish I had kept them all because I scribbled a lot of notes in the margins, probably some not fit for public consumption. Just let me answer the question, dang it! It was as though they were saying...
By the end of the book, Sarah Palin is planning her political comeback while baking cakes for her kids and grandkids. And at the fish tank, after more than 6 hours, past 1 a.m, the crowd has dwindled to about 10 people, sunk into their chairs, surrounded by empty beer cans.
And I'll pull out a road map. I want to show Piper the way to Michigan.
Whoa!
Okay, we're not quite done. As I was writing this book, a friend forwarded to me a widely circulated email that describes one ordinary citizen's view of my governorship. It is so Alaska, I had to share. Now, these adolescent screechers are obviously not scuba divers, and no one has ever told them what happens when you continually jab and pester a barracuda. Without warning,
it will spin around and tear your face off. Should have known better.
Janet Henry gathers her stuff to leave. She was one of the most convincing Sarah Palins, in a black satin jacket and deerskin skirt. Between the guffaws, Henry says hearing almost the entire book might have changed her thinking about Sarah Palin.
Oh, yeah. She's much more interesting than I thought.
That story was produced by Sylvia Maria Gross of station KCUR in Kansas City. Tuned to Sidetrack. Everything you know about Santa Claus is wrong. Well, that is according to the author of a new book that peels back the layers of so-called Christmas magic and finds cutting-edge science instead. The book is called The Truth About Santa, Wormholes, Robots, and What Really Happens on Christmas Eve. It's published by Bloomsbury. The man behind it is Gregory Mohn, a contributing editor at Popular Science magazine. I talked with him recently and asked him what was the biggest truth about Santa.
The biggest truth is perhaps that he's real and that he really does all these supposedly impossible things every year. Perhaps the most startling truth is that he does not do it all himself, that he does have helpers, or what he calls lieutenants, roughly 200 to 300 of them. And they help him out with his deliveries because, in reality, it really would be impossible for one person to do all this, even with time travel.
Well, you calculate that it would take something like 190 years.
Exactly.
To complete his Christmas duties.
Right. I mean, now, if you think of the standard model we know from the movies and the books and the stories, you've got the one guy on the sleigh running around the world, flying around the world, going down the chimney, dropping off the presents, et cetera, et cetera. Even with an incredibly fast sleigh, you could imagine that it would take him 3 minutes to get from destination to destination, maybe 3.5 minutes. You know, then you'd have another 30 seconds or so to get down the chimney, and let's say he hurries up while he's eating his cookies and drinking his milk and figuring out what present to leave, that will be another 30 seconds. So if we say 3 minutes and then another minute, that's 4 minutes per house. If we then say he visits 200 million homes, that's 800 million minutes, or roughly 1,500 years. Now, if you take out the travel time, which is actually the reality, because for him to get from one home to the next actually takes no time or less than no time because he can time travel. That still works out to, as you said, 190 years.
So Christmas Eve night for him is,
as
you say, It's a pretty long night.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I personally thought he did it all by magic. Which
right.
Is,
well, you know, it's tricky because, I mean, there's the science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke, wrote that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. You could kind of reverse that and say a lot of these things that appear to be magic might just be incredibly advanced technology. And that's what's happening here with Santa.
Right.
And I think that's what I'm trying to do with this book, is sort of show people that it's not all magic, that technology and science really can do these, allow people to accomplish these seemingly impossible things.
Right, because everything you talk about, you tie in with cutting-edge science.
Right, exactly. You know, I'm just a reporter, so I don't know everything about Santa's operation. I just did my research, talked to the people I could talk to. And so there were some cases where, you know, a few questions remained, and I had to sort of go out and see where we are in our world with research and with modern technology. And in a lot of cases, we're pretty close to being able to do what Santa can do.
Well, let's talk about the actual traveling part, as we touched on a second ago. You say that Santa himself travels with a warp engine on his sleigh.
Right. So Santa's lieutenants are jumping around from house to house via what are known as wormholes. They allow them, these structures allow them to time travel as they move from house to house. So they spend 30 seconds in a house, but then they can go back in time 30 seconds and end up in the next house before they got there effectively. So Santa himself has a warp drive enhanced sleigh that allows him to basically get across the world in literal or no time. His technique is, if he's trying to get from point A to point B, what warp drive does is it effectively pulls point B closer to him so that his trip becomes much shorter. He enters into kind of, I guess you could imagine, another dimension in a way. And what happens is it gives the illusion that his reindeer and his sleigh are flying. But what's really happening is they're just jumping off rooftops, entering a warp bubble, and then popping out of a warp bubble above another rooftop and dropping down.
Which seems absolutely amazing. But when you write about this stuff, you actually tie it into modern-day theories about this sort of stuff. You know?
Right. Well, you know, this warp drive is one of these classic science fiction concepts. But, you know, real, actual working physicists have tested the idea and tried to see how it might actually work in the real world. And, you know, the modern-day versions, we haven't quite figured it out, obviously. Otherwise, nobody would be commuting to work anymore, right? They'd just be hopping in a warp drive and getting it done very quickly. But, you know, they've found that there are tremendous mass and energy requirements, and that it's certainly not something we are going to, you know, make happen anytime soon. But it's also, they're pulling it out of the realm of the impossible, certainly. So I discuss a lot of that research in the chapter related to warp drive.
There's another interesting part in the book about, you know, where you talk about how long this takes and how old Santa is and how he keeps young by a series of medical robots.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, right, you've got this guy that in this one night is visiting all these homes, and even with his helpers, he does visit quite a few homes. He's eating cookies in almost everyone, drinking a glass of whole milk, perhaps a little eggnog. That is not a great diet for anyone. And yet he has lived for a very long time. So what Santa does is when he starts to get unhealthy, when his organs start failing or showing signs of distress, he actually has them replaced. Up at the North Pole, he has some pretty amazing technology that allows him to print new organs. And then obviously we wouldn't want poor Mrs. Claus having the responsibility of doing that kind of major surgery on her husband. And the elves aren't fit for that kind of work either. So he has autonomous or independently controlled robots that do all of this for him. Now, you know, in our world, we have robotic surgery, but it's a very different sort of a thing where a surgeon is standing in another room controlling a robot. It's called teleoperation. But researchers are working on autonomous robotic surgeons as well. They're not going to be able to do anything as complex as an organ transplant right now, but these sorts of things might not be impossible.
The other part of this book that I really find interesting is the surveillance that Santa uses to really find out who's been naughty and nice.
And it's a little bit frightening.
It is a little bit frightening. You know, you think that that Santa is kind of a, you know, up there, but, you know, a little give and take, you know, when he hears things. But in your book, everything reaches Santa's ear.
Absolutely. Well, we know that Santa knows if we've been bad or good. You know, he knows when kids talk back to their parents. How does he do this? He's got to have this sort of technology spread all around. He really doesn't miss anything. And, you know, it is a little bit frightening, and it also is a touchy subject. When I was talking to some real-world researchers about this, when I say real-world, I don't mean to imply that Santa is imaginary. I'm merely just saying our world versus his world, because let's be honest, his world is a little bit different with all this technology and the time travel and everything else. But anyway, when I was talking to a unmanned robot researcher who builds these kind of miniature flying robots, he was very touchy and didn't really want to speak with me about it. And I could only assume that he is somehow involved with Santa's research. Perhaps he does a few side projects for him, works on technology development. I don't know exactly, but certainly that was that seemed to be a safe assumption.
And again, these technologies are kind of out there already.
Right. They a lot of these things that I describe in the book are actually real technology, you know. Ornaments, listening devices in the ornaments, or the angel at the top of the tree that can, you know, has hidden cameras inside the angel that can track motion in 3D, pick up noises and sort of locate the source of the sound. These are all real technologies.
So what really inspired you to put this book together?
Well, you know, I think in part to sort of bring Santa out of this realm of pure magic. Not that I think there's anything wrong with magic, but I think that, you know, it's important to also show what science and technology are capable of. And I also admit, you know, I do hope that while this is a book sort of for grown-ups, I do hope that, you know, at least some kids read it and get inspired to think a little bit more about science and technology and the potential for science and technology and how science can really make the impossible possible.
That was Gregory Mohn talking about his new book, The Truth About Santa, Wormholes, Robots, and What Really Happens on Christmas Eve. It's published by Bloomsbury. This is Sidetrack. Rebecca Scheer is a closet Christmas music junkie. At this point, she's okay with admitting it. For her, the real meaning of the holiday season is all about bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens.
I have a confession to make. Each year, when the local radio stations shift into all Christmas, all the time mode, I listen. Forgoing Morning Edition, abandoning All Things Considered, and enduring the every 10 minutes ad blitz of commercial radio, I spend an entire month eating up everything from Johnny Mathis and Bing Crosby to Barry Manilow and Mariah Carey. I even guzzle up those dog barking and cat meowing versions of Jingle Bells with a schlock-dipped candy cane spoon. But I wonder about some selections in the 24/7 holiday repertoire. Like, other than the fact that it takes place in an evidently chilly environment, what exactly does Baby It's Cold Outside have to do with the most wonderful time of the year? And as for Jewel's so-called Christmas version of her top 40 hit, Hands, someone ought to tell the singer-songwriter-poetess that the addition of chimes and a children's choir do not a holiday tune make. Then there's that other incongruous, omnipresent ditty, My Favorite Things.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
Sung by everyone from Babs to Barry to, yes, those good old dogs and cats. This one plays quite heavily in the annual holiday rotation. And sure, we've got the sleigh bells, the snowflakes, the silver-white winters melting into spring, but we've also got whiskers on kittens and schnitzel with noodles. And besides, in The Sound of Music, from whence this number originally came, wasn't Maria singing it to the Von Trapp kids in the middle of a thunderstorm, in the middle of Germany, in the middle of the summer? Then, this year, it clicked. When I heard that Coral Ridge Mall was opening its doors at 7 o'clock the morning after Thanksgiving, and retailers like Kohl's were ringing their registers as early as 5:30 a.m., I understood. With its rhyming roll call of things, Rodgers and Hammerstein's classic has become a tribute to that other standby of the season. Shopping.
Bright copper kettles, warm woolen mittens, white cotton dresses with blue satin sashes. Suddenly, I envision shoppers attacking the shelves of Pier 1, Target, and Old Navy. I picture mall hoppers schlepping through the snow, lugging their brown paper packages tied up with string. Why, during the month of December alone, American adults will spend a record $1 billion splurging on things. That's an average outlay of $1,338 per schlepper. I mean, per shopper. Which brings me to confession number two. Even we Jews join in the spree. Granted, Hanukkah was not traditionally a gift-giving holiday. Originally, it was meant to commemorate the 8 days that the eternal flame miraculously burned in the ravaged temple after the Maccabees drove the Syrians from Israel over 2,000 years ago. But over the centuries, given the proximity of our little festival of lights to the big Yuletide, for many, myself included, some might say that Hanukkah has turned into a kind of Jewish Christmas. During my childhood, while many of my friends scampered to the tree to tear open gifts on Christmas Day, I scuttled to the menorah to rip open gifts on 8 days. The week before Hanukkah, my family would draw numbers to determine which night each of us would distribute our presents. To facilitate everyone's shopping, we'd even tack our wish lists to the refrigerator. And here's another confession. Growing up, I never considered such gift-giving wrong. Sure, it was satisfying after lighting the menorah and singing the songs to cap the evening with a copy of that Duran Duran LP I'd been coveting for months. But what I found even more gratifying was the night it was my turn to give the goods. After blessing the candles and belting a few rounds of Rock of Ages, I'd scurry upstairs, rummage beneath my bed, and cart my cargo back to the living room. Then I'd watch my big brother grin as he tore the shrink wrap off the latest Atari game. My little sister would squeal as she clutched her strawberry shortcake doll. Mom would beam as she unwrapped a new bottle of Charlie. And after trying on the perennial TJ Maxx necktie, hanky, and or socks, Dad would stand up, wade through the ribbons and empty boxes, and wrap me in his warm embrace. And I'd feel like $1 million. A mere fraction of the profits Walmart and Amazon.com are expecting right about now. These days, with the family lighting its menorahs in 3 separate states, we defer to UPS to decide who gives gifts on each night. But we still call each other up to light the candles and sing those songs together. We even post those wish lists, even if the message board has gone from the kitchen fridge to the World Wide Web. So, when it comes to shelling out the shekels for those things, I guess I'm just as guilty as the nuts who gulped their Folgers at 4 a.m. to grab the first Tamagotchis at Toys R Us. But I'd like to think that my own favorite things include something more. This silver-white winter, what matters most is bringing a smile to the face of those we love. And come the spring, when our bank balance bites and our finance charges sting, we should remember that. And then we won't feel so bad.
That essay from independent producer Rebecca Shear. For most of the year, independent producer Jason Sears' uncle sells heavy equipment machinery parts in the northwest Chicago suburb of Bartlett. But for 2 months, he earns a living as Old St. Nicholas himself. He has a real beard dyed white and nearly 1 foot long. He drives a red Ford pickup truck, which he calls his sleigh, and he wears red almost every day of the year. For the past 3 years, he has been the official Santa Claus for Chicago's Thanksgiving Day Parade. In addition, this year he was invited to assist with Chicago's official Christmas tree lighting ceremony. And he's actually a second-generation Santa. His father, who you'll hear singing at the beginning of this feature, was a Santa for over 35 years. So what's it like to be Santa 24/7? Just listen.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, and down Santa Claus Lane. Imagine how he's rolling through.
Ho, ho, ho! Santa Claus is the name. Jeff Curtis is the real name, though. And I'm a Santa Claus. Hopefully the parents are paying attention. I started with a short beard. I thought my beard was long. It was probably about 2.5 inches long. And I thought it looked just great. We don't shave it off and grow it every year. That would really be a pain because they don't grow as fast as you think. Good Santa beard, got to be 12. Some guys like it 13, 14 inches long. I happen to curl mine, so it ends up being about 8 to 10. So it looks pretty good. I haven't shaved in, I bet you, 6 years. There's only one lady allowed to trim my beard, and it's not Mrs. Claus. It's actually Santa's hairdresser. I belong to an organization, the Amalgamated Order of Real Bearded Santas, ORBS, founded out in California by a bunch of Santas that were on a shoot. They were in a commercial together. And the 4 turned into 8, 8 turned into 16. I believe the total is somewhere up around 1,800 guys. It's amazing. 4 years ago, I found them online. And at the time, their president, Tim, had Santa classes. But I had been a Santa for already about 3 years. I thought I knew everything. It's one of the best things we ever did. Both Mrs. Claus and I went to classes for an entire day. We learned a lot. Learned that if you're going to have a white beard on your face or wear a red cowboy hat, or have red Converse tennis shoes, you're Santa Claus. It doesn't matter where you are, what time of the year it is, you are Santa Claus. That is what children will see. If it's 10 o'clock at night and you're walking the street, and you're in Wisconsin, and you're stopping in at the Dairy Queen for an ice cream at 10 o'clock at night, and you've got a white beard and white hair, who are you? You're Santa Claus. You're in Wisconsin fishing, and you're Santa Claus in a boat. That's who you are. And if somebody says, "Are you Santa?" My answer is, yes, I am.
Santa baby, slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, and hurry down the chimney tonight.
As I've become Santa Claus, I have truly been won over by this character. It's believing, number one, in yourself, that you can do anything you want. That's very easy for me. My dad used to advertise in the Courier, have Saint Nick visit your house. And Dad used to get $10 a visit. He had done it for over 35 years. And to us, it was always a constant. Until I got older, I think I must have been in maybe fifth grade or fourth grade when Norm Davis, across the street from where we lived in Streamwood, had told me about he knew who Santa Claus was. Well, it was a shock to find out that the Santa Claus suit that he was talking about was in my dad's closet. After you find out about it, you have to keep it a secret from everyone else. One of the best things was on Christmas Eve, it's always a busy time for Santa Claus. My brother and I got the okay from my mom to go with Dad on Christmas Eve. We're in the back seat of this Chevrolet, which was huge for us kids. And Santa Claus is dashing in and out of houses. My dad has got his beard on and his wig and his hat, and he's coming out. He'd come into the car, and he is just hot. And we said, "Why are you hot?" He said, "Well, next time you look at me when we walk in." Sure enough, when we looked at the next stop, they're filming my dad with these huge bright lights that are just throwing the heat out. My brother and I just looked at each other and said, "Well, at least he's warm." But You don't realize what he goes through until after you do it. And that's when I kind of looked at my dad after I started this and said, I know how you feel in that that wig and beard now, but you just deal with it. We just had a real good time, a great time with Dad. He would always be laughing, and he'd laugh at whatever we did in the back seat. Always there. He was always smiling. Like I said, I never kind of, you know, remember making it home. I was always having to be carried by my dad from the car to bed because I could never stay up that late. I would always fall asleep. And I'd wake up the next morning and it'd be Christmas morning. Always amazing how I got from the car to the bed to Christmas morning. And I think that's really what made me understand Santa, that he's somebody that has, he has so much love. And he has the patience. He understood children. He taught me a lot. He taught me a lot. Oh, yeah. Sorry. When he asked me to take over, he must have known me pretty well. I didn't know if I was going to enjoy it. What a hoot. What a hoot. Couldn't believe how well that went.
I'm dreaming. Dreaming of a white.
That feature was produced and edited by independent producer Jason Sear. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.